They do not believe in any entity called a devil, and they do not believe in God. It is a mistake for you to assume that they do. They are atheists in the strictest sense of the word.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The US withdraws cooperation from the Russians over so-called ceasefire violations over in Syria. So as the US and Russia come closer to open war over there, we look at the air war. How would it pan out? Whose radars are best? Whose surface-to-air missiles can shoot down planes better? And is this war being used as a proving ground for World War III? Also, the drugs trade in the CIA. We have an interview with the journalist that passed away about 10 years ago. He's Gary Webb from the United States, who was investigating links between the cocaine trade and the Central Intelligence Agency. Apologies, there was no news from the Murdoch News at 6, but anyhow, Martin, we'll take full advantage of that. It gives us an extra few minutes to discuss Syria. Now, there's been a lot of accusations flying backwards and forwards, but the Americans finally pulled out, haven't they?
They have, but they claim that the Russians have violated the ceasefire agreement. But don't forget, the Americans were trying to keep the ceasefire agreement secret, because eventually the Russians insisted that it was made public. And the reason they wanted to keep it secret is because what they'd agreed was that the al-Nusra front would be separated from the rest of the so-called moderate rebels, and that then that what would then happen is that there would be joint operations by the Russians and the NATO forces against ISIS and the al-Nusra front. But the al-Nusra front are effectively in charge of eastern Aleppo. They're being armed, trained and directed by Western intelligence services, and they don't want to let them go. And there's obviously some tensions going on within the Russian within the US administration between the Pentagon and the White House and the State Department, because they're all at cross purposes.
There are several parts of Syria that are incursions from abroad, aren't there? I mean, there's the obvious most obvious are northern Syria, where the Turks are now ensconced, effectively annexing that part of the country, and also, of course, for many years, I think since the 67 war, the Israelis have been sitting there in the Golan Heights looking down on Syria.
Yeah, well, also, of course, British special forces were filmed inside Syria coming over from the Jordanian border. Of course, completely illegal. Those British special forces are an illegal occupation force, and the Russians
hang on a minute, because actually, look, let's just try and be realistic for a minute here, because the special forces operate really effectively outside the law, don't they? They're not actually under the purview of Parliament. They're more to do with the army.
No, I'm talking about international law, Tony. In international law, they have no right to be on Syrian soil. But they were filmed on Syrian soil. They were lucky because they were training a rebel unit, a terrorist unit, basically. The Russians then carried out an airstrike, but they warned the British special forces to get out. So they then got out of the place, and four of the terrorists they'd been training were then killed by the Russians. But of course, next time it happens, the Russians won't give a warning. They'll just kill British special forces. And British special forces will have no answer to give to this, because they're not supposed to be there, period. They're just not supposed to be there. And if they get killed when they're inside Syria, well, that's just too bad, isn't it?
Now, we're focusing a bit on the air war tonight, mainly because that is where these modern wars seem to have been won. I think probably ever since the Battle of Britain.
Well, it's funny you mention the Battle of Britain, because if it comes to an air war over Syria, it will be like a rerun of the Battle of Britain, but the Russians and the Syrians will be playing the RAF, and we will be playing the Luftwaffe. And, of course, the Russians and the Syrians have actually, between them, probably got the edge in this situation.
And, well, what makes you say that?
because they will be able to knock down planes and drones coming in. They'll be able to use electronic warfare to knock out NATO's very sophisticated electronic equipment, and they're not bluffing. And we may have to have the war now. We've reached the point where there's little point to negotiation, and it's quite possible that the Pentagon, with the bombing of the Syrian army units in Deir ez-Zor, and they've also been knocking out the bridges in Deir ez-Zor, because it's actually an enclave of civilians protected by the Syrian army, completely surrounded by ISIS, and they have been bombed. They not only bombed the Syrian army, they've also knocked out the bridges over the river inside the city in order to make it more difficult for the Syrian army to defend against the ISIS forces which are surrounding them. We haven't heard a lot about that in our media, but of course it's been covered by the Russians and others. So we're already effectively at war with Russia in Syria, and effectively this could escalate. But it's not. In the past, NATO has had overwhelming air superiority in Libya and elsewhere, but this time they won't.
But the Russians didn't shoot down any of these American jets, or the British drone
so far
that was attacking these.
No,
Syrians?
The reason they haven't so far is because they're trying to negotiate a sensible solution. But the war party in the United States, led by Hillary Clinton and others, were Ash Carter from the State Department, and the war. They want a war. They're banging on about it. What you've seen senior American generals this week going on. We're going to have a war with Syria, with Russia. Let's get on with it. And the Russians obviously are horrified. They don't want to have a war, but a bit like Britain in 1940, they're not going to back down, and they're pretty confident that their people. Don't forget,
You mentioned Ash Carter from time to time on here. I know he was actually in the Daily Mail today. Ash Carter's top aide spent $1,800 at an Italian strip club on a government credit card.
Well, yes.
So that's where your tax dollars are going, folks.
That's the least of his bad behaviour. I mean, what he and other, and Dunford, who's the head of the Pentagon at this time, when the attack took place on the Deir ez-Zor, it went on for over an hour. I was reading about the 82 soldiers that were killed. They came from all parts of Syria and from all communities. The majority were Sunnis, as most Syrians are, but there were plenty of Alawites and Christians who were also fighting alongside them. And of course, that's the reality, is that the Syrian government now has the support. According to NATO's own internal reports, they estimated that about 70-80% of the population support the Syrian government. And of course, they won the election 2 years ago pretty convincingly.
Yeah.
But that's totally ignored in the West. He's evil, he must go, blah, blah, blah. This is silly talk. Why they're worried is because if the Syrian army and its allies can clean al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda, out of eastern Aleppo, even though they are being supported by Turkish, American and British special forces and others, then the war's virtually over. Then the rebels have lost. But they can't allow that, and they need to have a war. They're worried that Trump might win the election, and then he might start negotiating with the Russians. So the obvious thing to do is, before we get to the election, is let's get the war going, so it doesn't really matter who wins who wins the election in the United States. But it's extremely dangerous and potentially a flashpoint for World War III.
Okay, South China Sea update. US-China tensions are rising after Ash Carter's comments standing aboard a US aircraft carrier. Defence Secretary Ash Carter told the US Navy sailors the country plans to sharpen our military edge in the Asia-Pacific region during an address Thursday this week. That's yesterday. An announcement came amid China's further entrenchment there in a multinational dispute over the South China Sea. The US remains the region's strongest military and security partner of choice, Carter said. While he sounds almost like he's selling himself, like G4S or something there, Carter said while speaking on the USS Carl Vinson in San Diego, CNN reported, along with creating military installations in one of the world's most important and accessible shipping channels. China's been fighting off the July ruling of the UN-backed tribunal that said it did not have absolute autonomy in the South China Sea. China called the Permanent Court of Arbitration's ruling a farce and has tried to tighten its grip on the waterway since 2012. But look, getting back to Syria, who's going to win this air war if and when it starts? Because one of the most important things is anti-aircraft missiles, and the S-400 is now in Syria and has been for a while. I mean, I know when it first arrived, the Russians were boasting, well, since the S-400 systems arrived here, the Americans haven't been flying around like they used to.
Well, indeed, and Konashev, I think it is the Russian commander, was saying that if they do try and attack us, they will find that these things have got capabilities and ranges which they haven't thought about. And they were pretty shocked when they fired cruise missiles from the Caspian Sea over Iran and Iraq, because they got an agreement from the Iraqi government, who are actually on the Russian Syrian side of this.
And why do they need planes? Can't they just use cruise missiles and drones?
The thing about the cruise missiles and drones is these new Russian systems are designed to take those out. And also, they've got very, very strong electronic warfare capabilities. You've got to remember that NATO's capabilities depend very much on computers and electronics. And what the Russians have been practicing is basically knocking out the computers and electronics. So the USS Donald Cook was in the Black Sea, and the Russians just demonstrated that they could knock out its electronics completely.
Now, aren't we looking at an interesting scenario here, weird and dangerous in a way, where you've got both sides saying, well, we can make a lot of political capital and possibly have an excuse to start a war if one of our planes is shot down by the Russians, or vice versa, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I think the Russians don't want war.
But it's not so... It's not, what I'm saying is it's not so so much gravitas to it if it's either a drone or a cruise missile or something.
It's not, but I mean, obviously, they're pretty angry about the attack on Deir ez-Zor, because it went on for over an hour, and both the Russians and the Syrians are fairly much convinced that was done quite deliberately by the Pentagon to undermine whatever negotiations were going on. And they don't actually trust the Americans anymore to negotiate, because Kerry was saying one thing, and meanwhile, what Dunford and the State Department were doing was something else. I think that the Russians and the Syrians are not prepared to negotiate anymore, because they don't believe that the West's in good faith. They can't deliver their proxies on the ground anyway. And let's just repeat this: the people controlling eastern Aleppo are Al-Qaeda. They are the people that we've supposedly spent the last 15 years and millions of deaths to defeat, and yet we are supporting them with weapons, including anti-tank weapons, including anti-aircraft weapons, in order to defeat Assad, who's the elected leader of Syria, and the Russians, who are a democracy, far more of a democracy than many Western states.
Well, there's been loads and loads of coverage night after night about Aleppo, blow by blow, but very, very little talk about places like Sana'a in Yemen.
Indeed. And also, of course, they're not mentioning the fact that most of the population of Aleppo is actually in the in western part of Aleppo, which is controlled by the government. They've got 1.5 million people there, but the rebels, the terrorists, are firing indiscriminately at the civilian areas of Aleppo. And they're also using the people in eastern Aleppo as human shields. And there was a discussion by Mizrutta, who's Italian, I think, from the UN, saying, well, why don't Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra in Aleppo leave? We can arrange for them to go. We will bring UN people in, and they can leave with their weapons and just leave. And the Russians said, this is interesting, that would be good, why don't they just go? But they're not prepared to go. And they're also, because they're being backed up by the British government and the US government. We are backing Al-Qaeda in eastern Aleppo, and they're no doubt being trained by British special forces.
And tonight, as we speak, the Russians are facing,
as they always have,
facing pressure to stop the bombardment of Aleppo. Russia said on Friday a draft UN resolution for a truce in the Syrian city of Aleppo was unacceptable, as Moscow faced growing international pressure to stop the devastating bombardment of the city backed by Russian air power. Russia's deputy foreign minister, Gennady Gatilov, said a draft put forward by France contained a number of unacceptable points, politicised the issue of humanitarian aid. But foreign minister Sergei Lavrov said Russia would support an eye-catching proposal by UN Syria envoy Staffan de Mistura to escort militants out of Aleppo personally. Russia was ready to call on the Syrian government to allow fighters from the Islamic al-Nusra front to leave the city So, Martin, this is just literally at the moment they're discussing all this. It doesn't sound to me as if the Americans have really got the... I mean, they're saying at the UN, we want to stop this, but would they ever shoot these Russian jets down?
Who would shoot them down?
The Americans.
Yes, potentially, yes. I mean, they're basically saying, some US general was saying this week, we will beat you heavier than you've ever been beaten or whatever. The rhetoric from the American side, if you look at Samantha Power, when they were called to the UN after the attack at Deir ez-Zor, she didn't even bother to go into the meeting. She just talked to the media and ranted and raved about how the Russians were this, that and the other. Totally ignoring the fact that the British, the RAF and the Americans had killed 82 soldiers. What would we do if the Syrians had killed 82 British soldiers? What would we do about that? Would we say, oh, well, never mind, it was just an accident?
Tonight, as part of this discussion at the UN Security Council, that Russia is saying that it would allow Islamist Nusra Front, this is the Sham Liberation Front they supposedly changed their name to, but no one seems to have taken much notice of that, to leave the city with their weapons, said Sergei Lavrov. But unfortunately, al-Nusra Front say they don't trust Assad, and so they're not going to agree to it.
Well, that's a fundamental problem, isn't it? Are these people under control? Can they be given orders by the West? Not necessarily. But in any case, if the West were to tell them to leave, they might just go. But they're not being told to leave. They've lost the war in Syria, effectively. And don't forget, it was the West that started the war.
I mean, how important is Aleppo in all of this?
It's very important if you look at its location. It's absolutely key to keeping open the supply lines from Turkey.
But even if Aleppo is liberated, you've then got problems up in the north of Syria, haven't you?
Well, you've got the Turks who've taken over a bit of chunk of Syria. But of course, they've got no right to be there any more than the Israelis have got a right to be in the Golan Heights. And ultimately, Assad has said, we are going to liberate every centimetre of our territory.
Some people might see Syria as a trap into which the Russians have now fallen, inexorably.
They're
never going to be able to leave there.
Well,
and they're going to be fighting forever.
Well, I mean, did you see there was an American general whose name I've forgotten who said, "Well, what the Russians have got to take account of here is they might lose aircraft, they might have body bags with their soldiers in, there might be attacks on Russian cities." Now, that's been interpreted by the Russians as a threat by the Americans to shoot their planes down, kill their soldiers, and attack their cities. And do you know what? They're not impressed. And they're not going to back down.
Well, it might
either.
Happen, mightn't it? If this resolution doesn't go through the UN, it just looks as if it won't go through. The Americans are saying, you've got to stop this bombardment now.
Well, they're not going to. And they've also got to decide, in that case, what they're going to do. Now, what can they do? Well, they could try and set up a no-fly zone. That's what's been talked about, a no-fly zone. Now, what that means is they've got to smash the Syrian-Russian air defences. Now, they might have the Israelis to help them. They might have, it'll be mostly the US with, the British hanging around like lapdogs as they normally do. But it's not at all clear that they would win that Battle of Syria. It would be very similar to the Battle of Britain, because I think that the technical edge is with the Russian side. And don't forget that they will be able to knock out aircraft carriers in the Mediterranean, for example. They have the Iskander missile. They've been moving their destroyers from the Black Sea. And it could be, a whole aircraft carrier or more could go down with 30,000 dead.
There's been a massive news story this week, I would consider massive, which has hardly got any coverage at all, as usual, in the London media, which is Bell Pottinger are in the spotlight for creating propaganda videos for the US military in Iraq. Now, this goes all the way back to 2004. Bell Pottinger, the PR company, created propaganda videos in Iraq on behalf of the US government in a contract worth more than $500 million over several years, according to revelations unearthed by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. Well done, folks. The work included creating short news segments made to look like Arabic news networks and fake insurgent videos. Sunday Times, which worked with the Bureau on the investigation, and other news outlets reported this weekend. That's just weekend just gone. The scale of Bell Pottinger's operation in Iraq was significant, costing on average more than $100 million a year, with the agency at one point employing almost 300 British and Iraqi staff. Bell Pottinger made about £15 million a year in fees from the work. Agency founder Lord Bell told the Sunday Times, with the bulk of the money going on costs such as production and distribution. The agency's work started in Iraq in March 2004, when it was tasked with promotion of democratic elections. But the Bureau said it identified transactions worth £420 million between the Pentagon and Bell Pottinger relating to contracts issued from May 2007 to December 2011, with a contract worth a similar annual rate reportedly in force in 2006 too. Bell Pottinger's employee Martin Wells said his work consisted of three types of products: TV ads portraying Al-Qaeda in a negative light, news items made to look as if they'd been created by Arab TV and with the origins sometimes hidden, and the production of fake Al-Qaeda propaganda films. Martin.
Yes, so in other words, when we see on our TV screens what is supposedly an Al-Qaeda video of beheading or whatever it is, the fact is we know that this was actually probably created with our own taxes in order to bamboozle us to believe that this is a genuine video. And this is all called psychological warfare. But of course, the psychological warfare is against the population of the Western countries, who are being basically fed a diet of distorted and downright deceptive information by their own intelligence services. Well,
what this chap working for Bell Pottinger said was that this Bell Pottinger also carried out some work under the Joint Psychological Operations Task Force, which a US defense official confirmed but declined to give details of. He said their work was signed off by the commander of coalition forces in Iraq, General Petraeus, although some of it went higher up the command chain and was approved by the White House. Bell, who in August announced his departure from the agency to form a new venture, Sans Frontier, told the Sunday Times he was proud of Bell Pottinger's work in Iraq. Now, I wonder if his departure had anything to do with this forthcoming release of this work by the Bureau of Investigative Journalists.
Well, it's a wonder, isn't it? I mean, basically, organisations like Bell Pottinger are paid by the intelligence services to basically put out fraudulent information, which is then used to bamboozle the population to support policies they otherwise wouldn't support.
And this has all been paid for by our taxes. Martin, what does this tell us about the news that's on our television tonight? Never mind about 2004.
Well, indeed.
Up until 2012, this was going on.
We can presume is when we look at the BBC or any mainstream news outlet and they give us a clip of supposedly independent information about what's going on, that in actual fact, more than likely, we can presume that that clip has actually been fabricated by an intelligence service.
For example, for the Aleppo convoy
that was supposedly attacked by the Russians in the air.
Things like these beheading videos, of course, from last year. Very, very suspicious.
Indeed.
But, I mean, this has been going on up until 2012 by this particular company. Effectively, that's at least 8 years we know about here. I'm sure it is still going on. This is just propaganda that's
churning out. Well, it is, but it's black propaganda. Don't forget, we are presented with videos which supposedly come from ISIS and Al-Qaeda, etc., and it turns out that they don't. And of course, don't forget that ISIS and Al-Qaeda are in fact being run by intelligence services anyway. The Russians and the Syrians are completely convinced that ISIS and Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra,
are being armed and trained by the Western intelligence services. Fairly new news agency, English language news agency from Iran this week called El Alam, which I'll put a link to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The web address is alalam.ir. And El Alam are saying only Sunni Muslims can live in Mosul. Now, this is literally this morning. A speech by President Erdogan is now saying that only Sunnis will be able to live in northern Iraq.
Well, exactly, and also the Iraqi government have told the Turks to get their forces out of Iraq because they're not there on invitation, and they said that they may go to war with them. Incidentally, of course, we're talking about what's going on in Aleppo and how terrible it is. We're not mentioning anything about Yemen, but we're not mentioning anything about Iraq. There's just about to be an assault on various places in Iraq, which is exactly the same as what's going on in Aleppo, except that the people doing the assault on the rebels there are the Iraqi government and NATO forces.
The Turkish president,
using exactly the same tactics as the Russians.
The Turkish president made no reference to Mosul's indigenous population of Iraqi Christians, predominantly ethnic Assyrians, who've maintained a Christian presence in the city for centuries, since the earliest days of the church, forced into a rapid exodus when ISIS stormed into Mosul in June 2014. Most of these displaced Iraqi Christians still live as internal refugees in the Ankawa enclave in northern Iraq's Erbil city. So what it sounds to me is if Erdogan is saying that there's Sunni Muslims only, nobody else is allowed in this city. How on earth can he say that?
Well, because this used to be the Ottoman Empire, and Erdogan wants to rebuild it. And in actual fact, the Iraqi government based in Baghdad are allies, remember. They've told the Turks, who are part of NATO, to get out of Iraq, otherwise they're going to go to war with them. Another flashpoint that nobody's taken any notice about.
Well, nobody's got a peace prize today for the Middle East. There's no surprise there. In fact, it was the Colombian president, Juan Manuel Santos, who's got the Nobel Peace Prize for his peace efforts in Colombia, even though this peace deal has been rejected.
The Nobel Prize Committee have probably done a reasonable job there. Santos has done his best to try and bring peace to Colombia. He's been frustrated by Uribe, the previous president, who is himself associated with the notorious paramilitaries and narco-traffickers from Alto Unidas Defensas de Colombia. And if you look at the breakdown of the votes in Colombia, the areas which have been most affected by FARC are the areas which have voted for peace. And the areas in which FARC has been basically another opposition has been eliminated by the paramilitaries associated with the previous president Uribe. They're the ones who have voted to against the agreement. But I don't think it's finished yet. I think both Santos and FARC are determined to continue with this peace process. And I don't think there's any. Thankfully, there's no real danger of a return.
Well,
to
one of the other
war.
People or groups nominated, because you can apparently even the EU won it. I think won the peace the Nobel Peace Prize 1 year is. The White Helmets were nominated, but Martin, they are really just a kind of psychological warfare tool themselves.
Well, the White Helmets won the Right Livelihood Award, which is pretty disgusting, really, which was set up by Jacob von Uxkull, who I used to work with when I worked at New Economics Foundation. The White Helmets are massively funded by the British, the EU, and the US
taxpayer. Martin, they're unpaid.
No, the organisation.
And unarmed, the individuals that volunteer for
it. No, but the organisation itself is massively funded. £28 million, I think, they got from the British taxpayer last year. And their job is to go around taking photographs of shocking scenes in order to get us to realise how terrible
and
the Russians are.
And rescuing survivors from bomb sites.
Can I just comment on that? There is, in fact, a proper civilian civil defence force in Syria. And Victoria...
In government-controlled areas.
Victoria Beely is going to be speaking in Bristol next week. She's a journalist. I've got a thing about it. We perhaps put it on the show page. The White Helmets, when you look at the photographs of what they're doing, they're not in fact trained to do any of this. Their main function is to take photographs of shock horror stuff and then push it out to the Western media to say, isn't it terrible, all the stuff that's going on. So they're basically a psychological warfare outfit, and they were set up by James Le Mesurier, who's an ex-British psychological warfare officer based in Turkey, and they have a massive amount of funding from us, from the taxpayer. We've just been talking about Bell Pottinger being funded by the taxpayer to make up videos by Al-Qaeda. The White Helmets are funded by the taxpayer, by us, in order to tell us how terrible the Russians are. That's their role. They're embedded with Al-Nusra Front. And the picture of the boy that was covered in dust and all the rest of it, the guy who took that picture was then photographed with the other militants chatting and joking with them. And these militants were the ones who chopped the head off the Palestinian 12-year-old and made a video of it, which went round the world. Of course, it wasn't shown on our screens. Because that's not what we need to know. And what's happening is a concerted attempt to distort the truth about what's going on in Syria, and the White Helmets are very much part of that. They're a concept a concept created by PR and psychological warfare specialists.
But they're also helping people out of bomb sites. They're not just a concept.
No, I dispute that. I dispute that. In actual fact, it's quite likely they are embedded with al-Nusra. And so they took the photographs of the so-called the convoy that was supposedly attacked by Russian air forces, although the UN have now run back on that. So, well, it was attacked, but we don't know by who. And I think that the attack on the convoy was carried out by al-Nusra. Then the White Helmets take a film of it and say the Russians did this. What the White Helmets are frequently doing is they're taking pictures of people who've been killed by their own side and saying, oh, look, the Russians and the Syrians have killed these people. And in actual fact, they've been doing this all along. All of the rebels in Syria have been killing lots and lots of people they regard as their enemies, you know, Alawites, Christians, people who aren't Sunni Muslims. And then they say, oh, then they take photographs of it. When you see a photograph of a dead body can't tell you who killed them. And that's what they're doing. They're taking photographs of dead bodies that they've killed
just
themselves. And then saying, oh, look, this is terrible. This is what's going on here.
A quick correction, it's not Victoria Beeley, it's Vanessa Beeley.
Vanessa Beeley.
And maybe you could tell us when she's actually coming to
Bristol. Well, it's actually in my pocket. I've got it in the pocket of my jacket over here, so I'll have to do...
Okay, well, we'll do that before the end of the hour. But just a couple of corrections from last week's show. I always try and do these. Any inaccuracies you hear or any complaints you've got, do go on to our show page at thisweek.org.uk where you can comment on this show, put links, if you have got a correction, please do put a link in to show us where the correct information is. A couple of things I picked up myself on last week's, sorry to have made these errors, but anyway, I did say last week that there were 29 Conservative MPs who were being investigated for fraudulent elections from May 2015. In fact, the total is 31 Conservative MPs who are being investigated for fraudulent election returns from May 2015 across the country by something like 16, 17 different police forces, including our own Avon and Somerset force. It's a long time to have waited before this has been properly looked at and any charges are brought. The other one, though, was we did an item last week, do the world's super rich worship a god, and if so, which one? The actual speaker was Dr. Stanley Monteith, not Eustace Mullins, as I incorrectly said. But anyway, Martin, let's go back now to the Syria topic, because it was something, international affairs, that came up at the Conservative Party conference as well this week, with the new Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, putting his oar in.
And if you look at the course of events in the last 10 years, then I'm afraid you can make the case that it is partly as a result of that lack of Western self-confidence, political, military, economic, that in some material ways the world has got less safe, more dangerous, and more worrying. After a long post-war period in which the world was getting broadly more peaceful, the number of deaths in conflict has risen from 49,000 in 2010 to 167,000 last year. The global number of refugees is up by 30% on 2013, up to 46 million last year. And of course, much of that crisis in refugees can be attributed to the war in Syria. It is part of a wider arc of instability that sweeps across from Iraq to Libya. And this matters profoundly to our country, because it is the continuing savagery of the Assad regime against the people of Aleppo and the complicity of the Russians in committing what are patently war crimes, bombing hospitals when they know they are hospitals and nothing but hospitals, that is making it impossible for peace negotiations to resume, and that is prolonging a migration crisis that last year overwhelmed Europe's ability to cope. And when the violent extremism of Daesh is erupting across the face of the Middle East, we are inevitably seeing the contagion spread to cities in Germany, France, Belgium, and of course here in our country as well. And if that threat to travel continues to have a palpable chilling effect on tourism, perhaps even on trade, then for a great trading nation like Britain, that is a matter of deep concern.
Well, I mean, what we got from Boris Johnson there is the usual rubbish about Syria, what's happening in Syria. It's the dreadful Assad. The Assad that got a massive election victory 2 years ago, overwhelmingly supported by all communities in Syria. He's actually grown into the role of being president of Syria. Many of the people who opposed him in the streets in 2011 have come back round to supporting him because they see him as a bulwark against exactly the kind of extremists that the Western intelligence services and armed forces have been supporting. There was no mention there by Boris Johnson about the 82 Syrian soldiers killed partly by the RAF 2 weeks ago. It's completely distorted. And, of course, he's going on about Eastern Aleppo. There's all sorts of other violence going on in Syria, carried out by the rebels. But it's Eastern Aleppo they're focusing on, because that's where the war will be won or lost. And I'm quite sure that the Syrians and the Russians have now reached the point where they're not prepared to negotiate anymore. They want the war over, and that means that they've got to win in Aleppo.
So, I mean, ultimately, this is all being finished off because the Russians have taken command of the air. Do you think they're going to have that for the foreseeable future, or will the Americans start to contest?
Well, we discussed this earlier. And I think that the Russians are very cautious. They certainly didn't intervene in Ukraine.
The question is, will the Americans contest this?
Well, the question is, will they contest it? I think they might, but if they do, they'll lose. And this is what the Russians have been trying to do all along. They've been trying to put the US General Staff in the position where whatever they would like to do, the reality is they can't do it because they haven't got the power. And you've seen both Dempsey and Flynn, senior military figures in the US, who've deserted the ship because they basically said, well, we're supporting ISIS and al-Nusra, why are we doing this? And we can't possibly win. And so what the Russians are demonstrating with their kit produced by their nationalised arms industry is superior to NATO kit, because it's a lot of NATO kit basically is junk, well, created for profit.
Over the last 30, 40 years, in fact, it was a completely secret programme for something like 10 years, up until the first Gulf War, I believe, was when the first jet stealth bombers and stealth fighters were revealed by the US. It was interesting. I was having a chat to a British engineer who used to work for Plessy's earlier on this week, and he said that the UK pioneered the whole idea of having a stealth fighter, stealth bomber, stealth aircraft back in 1947, but quickly realised that a physically separated transmitter and receiver radar would defeat it, so they dropped it. And actually, this is called something called a bistatic radar, and that much of the money that's been spent on stealth technology, he believes, is completely wasted, because the technology by late 1940s had got beyond the wartime radar, and they realised that stealth was not going to work.
Yeah, well, the point I would make is that the Russian arms industry has been retooled. It's still run by the government for the government, so nobody makes any profit out of making weaponry in Russia. That's why they don't waste a single ruble. Whereas what you've got, things like the F-35 in the United States, massively expensive, massively over budget, and basically rubbish.
Because this radar and
the more like money you spend on stuff, the better.
But there's also something, we're being bamboozled, surely, because this stuff is so top secret, they're able to pull the wool over the eyes of the people sitting on the political committees that are funding it.
Well, don't forget, they're also paying for the campaigns of the people sitting on those committees. And we had Media Benjamin speaking from the US in Bristol last night at a Stop the War meeting, and she was saying, well, in every constituency, every congressional district in the US, they've got a factory producing weaponry, and they make sure that's the case, so that every single congressperson has to support the military industry, because it's all in their constituencies. But what it leads to is massive overspending on military goods, which are of substandard. The Russian socialist system, if you like, where if you're going to produce weapons, we're not going to do this from the private sector, we're not going to do this as make a profit, we are just going to produce the weapons that our military needs to do what it needs to do.
Let's get into a bit of this military technology now. The article is something called the militaryaerospace.com site, article by John Keller, The headline is "Stealth Detecting Bistatic Radar is Back in the News." He also talks about something else as well in this, another kind of parallel technology to this. Bill Sweetman wrote on the Aviation Week Defence Technology blog this month of a formerly secret project to defend Swedish airspace against stealth cruise missiles with a bistatic radar approach called the Associative Aperture Synthesis Radar, AASR. This AASR program was cancelled in 2000 because at the time experts no longer considered cruise missiles to be a threat, amazingly. US bistatic radar and other anti-cruise missile programs have fallen by the wayside as well, as research dollars have shifted to other priorities. Well, it doesn't seem as if the people who are making decisions in the Western world about how defence money is spent really know, because so much of this is top secret. They aren't in the best position to assess what the threat is. The military aren't.
The basic logic of what goes on is, in the West, the military-industrial complex is out of control. And in actual fact, they want to buy the most expensive systems, the most complex systems, the ones that cost the most, because the more money you spend on weaponry, the more profit is made by Boeing, by BAE Systems, by Rolls-Royce, whoever. And it's all geared around making profits for those companies. It's not driven by military
reasons. Is this the reason,
military
though, the Russians have had the confidence to take and hold the air superiority in Syria?
That's because they know that their kit is produced. The Russians are in a very difficult position. Every ruble they spend on military is money that they can't spend on schools, hospitals, roads in Russia. So they're very careful about how they spend their money, because there's no profit to be made from it, apart from selling on to third countries. So that means that, in fact, the generals are in charge of the policy in Russia. In the West, the people in charge of the policy are the CEOs of the military-industrial complex. And, of course, they're not soldiers.
Well, something called the Joint Strike Fighter is supposed to be taking over from most of our military jets in the US. In fact, many countries in NATO, including the Australians. And a few years ago, on the ABC channel over there, they did a report on the effectiveness of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. So I thought we'd have a listen to that now, because we've done reports, it's sort of a bugbear of mine really. I call it the scam jet of the century, that fantastic amounts of money are being spent on this, and one of the great advocates for it, for whatever reason, was George Osborne, who's now out of the way. So we'll see if he's still, or if the programme is still going to be there for the British military to buy this plane. Anyway, this is what ABC in Australia, and specifically their programme, ABC Late Line, with the reporter Connor Duffy, made of the F-35. The Joint Strike Fighter, which the British are committed to buying so many of.
Mastery of the skies doesn't come cheap.
The F-35 Joint Strike Fighter is a highly diversified fifth-generation tactical aircraft.
But for $20 billion, you'd hope to come close. Back when the RAAF signed on to the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program in 2002, the jet's makers dubbed it Lightning, promising it would revolutionise air combat and secure Australia's defence needs for decades.
The F-35 displays its lethal spectrum of air superiority as the next generation fighter for America and its allies.
But now an early review is in, and the JSF has been shot down.
If Australia goes ahead with the Joint Strike Fighter purchase, the RAAF will be ineffective for the next 30 to 40 years.
The RAND Corporation in the United States prepared an analysis of the JSF's ability to match rival Russian and Chinese jets in close-range combat. The results were damning. The report says the JSF is
double inferior relative to modern Russian-Chinese fighter designs in visual range combat,
and has
inferior acceleration, inferior climb, inferior sustained turn capability.
It concludes that the JSF
can't turn, can't climb, can't run.
I think it's very damning. It makes very clear that in comparison to the Sukhoi, within visual range combat, to use their terminology, the JSF is doubly inferior.
The RAND analysis was prepared before a simulated war game exercise called Pacific Vision that was held at a Hawaiian airbase in August. Five Australian defence personnel took part in the exercise. Now there are suggestions that the results of those war games are just as scathing of the Joint Strike Fighter. In the mock battle, the JSF, F-22 and Super Hornets were dubbed the Blue Team and had to defend an attack by a Red Team made up of Russian-built Sukhoi fighters. The results are classified, But Lateline has obtained an email from a former RAAF flight test engineer who says he has been briefed on the exercise. In late August, Peter Goone, who is in regular correspondence with Defence, wrote to the head of the Defence Material Organisation, Dr. Steve Gumley, and the Defence Minister, saying that the results of Pacific Fission were disastrous for the JSF.
Red Force dominated the exercise, going up against two versions of Blue Force, both of which were roundly defeated. One way the Red Force summation of events has been described is that it was like clubbing baby seals. In addition to this rather blunt Red Force summation, the wargaming exercise demonstrated the JSF aircraft were next to useless, while the Super Hornets of both Blue Forces were seriously and significantly overmatched, aka useless. Hundreds of Blue Force aircraft were lost in the first 20 minutes.
Liberal backbencher Dr. Dennis Jensen says the email warning is credible.
Yes, I think it is. Certainly from the results that I've heard from the Pacific Vision exercise, bore out very much the analysis that RAND Corporation had in their pre-brief.
But a leading defence analyst is not convinced by the email and says the Pacific Vision exercise wasn't about comparing the two jets.
I don't think it's credible that the JSF came up as badly as some rumours are having it in this exercise.
Andrew Davies says he's seen unclassified simulations from the plane's manufacturer, Lockheed Martin.
It was shown that the JSF would, in the majority of cases, defeat an aircraft like a Sukhoi, well beyond visual range.
He says the constant sniping at the JSF project is causing frustration in Air Force ranks. Connor Duffy, Lateline.
That's, as I said, Connor Duffy there from ABC News in Australia. Martin, also more recent news on the F-35. They're saying that the peeling and crumbling of the insulation on the planes is causing problems. That's in the Washington Post, and also on the nationalinterest.org, news is that this is just literally this week, almost a squadron's worth of Joint Strike Fighters inside defence are saying may not fly for months, as Colin Clark wrote for Breaking Defence. US Air Force and Royal Norwegian Air Force have suspended flight operations for 15 of these F-35s, 13 American and 2 Norwegian ones, after finding peeling and crumbling insulation in the avionics cooling lines between the fuel tanks. Doesn't sound very healthy. And are these things actually up to the job?
Well, the answer is probably no, and the reason is, as we've just been suggesting, the whole drive of Western policy is to spend as much money as possible in order to keep the profits of the arms industry up. That doesn't mean that you end up with kit which is actually usable, and it doesn't mean that you're going to win the follow-on wars that you're going to fight with them.
Well, the wider future for Syria, is it now a done deal then? The Russians, if the Americans don't have the kit to really intervene in the air over there, well, certainly with actual aircraft, they may have anti-aircraft missiles and that sort of thing. Is it almost all over with Aleppo and it's just really northern Syria and the Golan Heights
I would like to think so. I mean, what we really need to see now is a rapid end to the war, with the defeat of the mostly foreign factions like al-Nusra and Daesh, who don't actually who have no interest in a solution. And the Russians have also been talking to other factions and saying, look, we are willing to negotiate with people who have taken up arms against the Syrian government. We know you've got legitimate grievances, but the time has come for us all to call a ceasefire and settle and create a government of national unity led by Assad. Now, that's not acceptable to the West, it's not acceptable to the Israelis, it's not acceptable to Hillary Clinton, but the fact is they can't win the war. They've done enough to make the poor old Syrians suffer miserable circumstances for years. And of course, Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, was on French television some years ago saying that he was approached before the war began by British officials who said, we are going to start an armed uprising in Syria. I noticed that Boris Johnson didn't mention any of that in his little speech to the Conservative Party conference, that the British have had the finger pointed at them by Sarkozy's foreign minister, that you started the war. So all the people that have died and all the destruction and all the death and all of the misery, we started it.
Okay, back to the White Helmets and Syria. Finally, Martin, the White Helmets, Al-Qaeda with a facelift, is a four-minute video on YouTube which reveals the truth, supposedly, about the grouping. The Syria Solidarity Movement, including Ava Bartlett, Vanessa Bealey, Ken Stone, and Hands Off Syria, which made the video, has extensively researched White Helmets' funding and their role. And you were mentioning that Vanessa Bealey herself, who has been to Syria, I understand, will be here in Bristol next week. So
yeah, there's a Bristol Open inquiry into the UK bombing of Syria, public meeting at the ARC, which is 27 Broad Street, Bristol, BS12HG. It's Friday the 4th of November, so it's not next Friday the 4th of November at 7 o'clock, and it costs £3.72. You have to go on Eventbrite to get a ticket. But Vanessa Bealey has been extensively all over Syria. There's another chap called Reverend Andrew Ashdown, who I believe is a British priest who's been over there, and we're being told a load of lies about what's going on there. You need to listen to people who have actually been on the ground.
It sounds to me like, although Bell Pottinger don't have that particular contract anymore, someone else does.
Well, indeed, we're basically being told a load of fibs all the time, and basic factual information about what's been happening there has been denied to people, including, as I said, Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, pointing the finger at the British for starting the whole war in the first place by beginning an armed uprising. And I think that's pretty much what's happened. The protests of 2011 were weaponised by Western intelligence services and special forces quite deliberately, but they just weren't able to achieve their goal of overthrowing Assad in the way that they overthrew Gaddafi. And of course we've just had the report by the Commons Select Committee on Libya, which basically said that everything we were told about Libya, there was going to be a massacre in Benghazi and all the rest of it, all rubbish.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol.
Now, Martin, we're moving on to go back to the Conservative Party conference now to hear a little bit from our local MP, Liam Fox, who's the International Trade Minister, and a part of his speech was a very empty hall, only about maybe a third or a quarter full, but Liam Fox was talking about international trade. Really, there's two, aren't there? There's David Davis, who's the Brexit Minister, and him is the new International Trade Minister or Secretary, and he's got his own marvellous new department. So in a way, these two, as David Davis is trying to get the best deal from Europe, Liam Fox is out there trying to get the best deal from the rest of the world.
Now, while we remain inside the European Union, we are bound by its rules not to negotiate any new trade agreements, as Boris repeatedly reminds me. But we are able to discuss the impediments that we might wish to eliminate ahead of agreements that we might reach with other countries when we leave. And that's why you will hear even the most fervent advocates of a free trade agreement with the United Kingdom reiterating that they have to deal with the EU first. And as long as we remain a member, we will push continually for EU agreements that open up global trade, such as CETA, the EU trade agreement with Canada. Their prosperity increases our prosperity, and a more open global market can genuinely be a win-win for us all. And both while we remain in the EU and after we leave, we will continue to push the case for Britain as a great place to do business. Now, in case any of you haven't noticed, the sky didn't fall down on the 24th of June. For instead of investors fleeing the UK, we've seen a record amount of inward investment. We saw the $24 billion investment by the Japanese company SoftBank in Cambridge, as well as a host of others, including Apple and GSK. And why does investment come to Britain? It comes because we have many natural advantages, advantages that we will continue to exploit. We have a system of law, including commercial law, that is admired across the whole world. We have a skilled workforce, low levels of industrial disruption, low regulation, low taxation, some of the best universities in the world, a strong research base. We speak English, and we're in the right time zone for global trading. Why would anyone not want to invest in this country?
Well, it's whistling in the dark, really. I mean, what he's saying is, yes, we're going to be all right, it's going to be fine. But the fact he mentioned the Canadian trade agreement there, and he certainly
this is CETA, S-I-T-A.
Yes, and I've got a little note about this here. If you like TTIP, you'll love CETA. Now, in actual fact, I'd like to know from Liam Fox, are we going to sign up to TTIP? Because that's what Hillary Clinton wants, that's what Donald Trump wants, that's what Angela Merkel wants. But if we sign up to TTIP, we'll be in exactly the same position as the rest of the EU, in which EU regulations will be merged with Canadian and American regulations, and we'll all have to work with those regulations. Or is Britain, having left the EU, not going to sign up to TTIP? In actual fact, the EU isn't going to sign up to TTIP because the French are opposed, and so are many Germans. So, as I understand it, Liam Fox mentioned that he was in favour of CETA, so he must be in favour of TTIP. But what that means is that we will have to have EU regulations by the back door via TTIP. There's no such thing as a free market out there. It's a fantasy. Everybody is part of some organisation or other that determines the rules of the market that they're in. There is no free market apart from that. So if Britain's going to leave the EU, are we going to leave TTIP and CETA as well? Or are we going to sign up for that, in which case we might as well not have bothered to leave the EU?
We are Bristol's first community radio station. BCFM 93.2.
Our final item tonight, Gary Webb. Martin, do you want to say something about him? Because he was an investigative journalist in the West Coast US who was looking into all sorts of connections between the CIA and drug dealing.
Yeah, he was the one. He was the journalist that used to work with Mike Rupert, the police officer, that exposed the fact that the Iran-Contra affair and Colonel Oliver North, who was running it all, basically they were funding the Contra rebels in Nicaragua, who killed 30,000 civilians, mostly women and children, with cocaine from Colombia, which was being brought into the U.S. via MENA Air Base in Arkansas when Hillary and Bill were in the governor's mansion there. And Gary Webb exposed all of this. There's been a film made about it called Dark Alliance, I think, a Hollywood film. But he then eventually committed suicide by shooting himself twice in the back of the head, as you do if you're an American investigative journalist.
Investigative reporting is being sort of squeezed out of the picture, and I think intentionally, because it tends to ruffle feathers. I mean, good investigative reporting does ruffle feathers. It draws lawsuits, and it gets newspapers in trouble.
Old pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ship.
My name's Gary Webb. I am an investigative journalist. I've been an investigative journalist for about 25 years for daily newspapers. And in 1996, I wrote a series of stories entitled Dark Alliance, which was about CIA involvement in drug trafficking. What my story showed was that the cocaine that was being sold in those neighborhoods was coming from mainly one source, and this one source was being used to finance a guerrilla war in Central America. The general idea of the CIA dealing drugs was something that the American mainstream press had never written about before, and that's why it prompted outrage among blacks, among drug reform activists, among politicians, by the CIA, by every federal agency involved in the drug war, because it showed they weren't doing their jobs, that it was a fraud. But right after we published the stories, the support we got from the media was very favorable. Newsweek magazine did a big piece on the story and said it was well documented and well researched. The website was getting like a million hits a day. There were marches in Watts, there were marches in Compton, there were candlelight vigils. Every California senator demanded an official investigation. So the story itself is really building momentum. The government reaction was no reaction. And this, I believe, was a very careful strategy, because nobody was going to believe the government if they came out and said we didn't do it. The proof was fairly overwhelming, since we had all these government documents showing that it had happened. So what happened was they let the so-called liberal press speak for them. And they had the national security reporters at the Washington Post, who coincidentally used to work for the CIA, right story and saying it doesn't mean anything.
That's the voice of Gary Webb there. I'll put links up to that complete thing, the Dark Alliance. Gary Webb was working at something called the San Jose Mercury News in California when he so-called committed suicide. Anyway, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that's Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe and Withywood, Mark Brain. Also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialect airs on BCFM every Tuesday at noon. Our show page for your comments is onewordthisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Do join us for the politics show at the same time next week.